This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stacio. For his 14th birthday, Charles Dew received a .22 caliber rifle and a copy of Lee's Lieutenants. The history of Robert E. Lee's army and the gun are just two examples of a boyhood steeped in Confederate nostalgia and the ideology of white supremacy. Today, Charles Dew is a respected historian of the South. But for his latest scholarship, he turned inward to examine how he acquired and subsequently rejected a racist belief system of his youth. His memoir is called The Making of a Racist, and Charles Dew joins me now. Welcome, Charles.
Thank you, Frank. Nice to be here.
Good to have you. You've been teaching Southern history now for more than 50 years. This memoir is a bit of a departure for you, an intimate personal history. Tell us how you came to write it.
It is different for me. It's not the sort of thing I had done before as a historian. We were trained in graduate school to be social scientists, which meant you didn't put yourself into the story. But as I've taught the history of the South, I've often found myself turning to my own stories about how I grew up to illustrate things to my students. And my experience is when I start telling these tales, I get their attention. They stop surfing the web or looking around the room. They focus in on me because I'm talking about my life growing up in the Jim Crow South and absorbing those racist views.
I know that you spoke at a Southern conference on slavery, and you had a question from a black student that stopped you in your tracks. The question is, how did someone as white as you come to study our history? How did you respond?
I stammered around for a minute. We often get questions in class we don't know how to answer, and when we do, we do a little two-step and try to figure out something to say. But I actually stopped and thought, and I said, you know, I think what's motivated me to study black history, to study slavery, to study civil rights, has been that I grew up on the white side of the color line in the Jim Crow South, and I was oblivious to what was right there in front of me. I just did not see it. And my ancestors did the same thing with slavery, I've come to believe. And so that's motivated me, I think, as a historian to try and sort of get behind the veil and explain our not seeing, if that makes sense.
It does make sense. How were you awakened? Was it all at once? Was it gradual? Tell us about that.
It was a very gradual process, and looking back on it, I'm really sort of tortured by how slow it was. I had never been north of the Potomac when I came to Williams as a first-year student, and my first day on campus, I realized I was in a new world. I had an African-American classmate living in my dormitory, and I'd grown up in the South where a very rigid racial etiquette governed how white and black interacted when we were in each other's presence, and here was someone who was a classmate. That was a new world for me, and my education really began before I walked into the classroom. I had other experiences. I had some teachers who were absolutely fantastic. I took courses in Southern history that blew all of the mythology that I had grown up with about the South and the Confederacy, pretty much blew it right out of the water. So between my lived experience and my education, I began moving away from my native culture.
Well, let's talk about that education. Williams College, not necessarily, a native son of the Jim Crow South would find themselves getting an education. How did you come to go to school there?
That's a very good question. And my father, who was very rigid in his racial views, had a lot to do with it. My father was a lawyer, and he would occasionally be in New York City on business for clients, and my brother and I, my older brother and I, were the only two children, both boys, and Pop believed deeply in education, and his way of measuring an educated person was language. If they wrote well, if they spoke well, he had a habit of asking them where they had gone to college, and a disproportionate number of the men he met in New York who spoke well and wrote well had gone to Williams. And he decided, this was back in the 1950s, this would be a good place for his two sons. So he basically told my brother, you'll go and try it for a year. And that's when fathers could do that and get away with it. And I just followed along in my brother's footsteps. So that's basically how it happened.
You got there, and when you were there, you discovered a particular document that, as you say, the awakening was gradual, but there was a kind of an earthquake, a moment that really shook you, and this was a particular document you discovered at Williams. Tell us about that.
Yes, I was, well, this happened actually when I came back to Williams to teach. I was called over to our rare book library one day. The librarian had just made a new acquisition. It was a price list, a slave price list issued by a slave trading firm in Richmond, Virginia, a printed form giving categories of men, women, and children with a price range inked in for each category. And when I looked at that document, I thought that is, in essence, the distillation of slavery into one page. Human beings as property, bought, sold like livestock. And it had a sort of gut-wrenching effect on me. Children were sold by height, beginning at 4 feet. There was a category in the market report at the bottom, good young woman and first child, with a price for that mother and child combination. Just seeing that document made me realize what my ancestors in the antebellum South had been doing.
Now, you say when you see a document like that, it's jarring, and certainly it should be, but of course it wasn't. The slave traders, the plantation owners, looked at those documents every day of their lives, and it didn't jar them at all. In fact, it was part of a system, an ideology of white supremacy that had been carefully cultivated and passed on over the generations. How is it that a document like that doesn't jar a human being?
I don't think it's possible, if you're a thinking human being, to see this and not have a profound reaction to it. I pass copies of this document, Xerox copies, out to my Southern history classes at the beginning of the semester, and I don't say anything. I just say, take a look at this and tell me what you see. And they are initially dumbfounded by it. They can't figure it out. And then it dawns on them, these are human beings, and this is a price list. And it leads to a very rich discussion. And I say much of what we're going to be studying this semester is trying to come to grips with this, how this came into being, how it was sustained, the lengths white Southerners went to defend this system, even to secession and war.
Let's talk about how it's sustained, because I think it's important to see, as you have an economic system that's actually dependent on free labor or cheap labor or undervalued labor. That's our economic system today, and it was back then. So now you have to support this somehow because it's inherently unfair. Anybody would look at the document and say, well, that's crazy and not right. So you have to build an ideology, a lie, white supremacy. Talk about how it works, and let's maybe use the example of that .22 caliber rifle and a book that you received also, Aeneas Africanus, as well as Lee, this indoctrination process that is very, very intentional.
Yes, it is. I make the point that the things that were read to me and that I read as a boy growing up in the South were just steeped in racism. My first memory is of my mother reading a book, a children's book to me, entitled Ezekiel. And Ezekiel is an African-American boy who lives on the St. John's River. It's all told in dialect. And literally the first thoughts that I have as a human being relate to that book, it being read to me in my mother's lap. The Aeneas Africanus book I read as a teenager, that's one of these stories about the, quote, faithful darkie, unquote, who was devoted to his white folks, who was sent off with the family silver during the Civil War and returns just in time for the big wedding after the Civil War. It's all told in dialect. It's all supposed to be hilarious. And again, these are things that I just absorbed as a boy growing up in the South during that era. And it started early and continued into my teenage years.
But the reproduction of these stereotypes is critical to sort of teaching the lesson of white supremacy. And anyone who breaches this code is severely disciplined. And so, I mean, you talk a little bit about sort of feeling this, I think you call it a Jim Crow lightning moment involving a black man coming to your home. And recognizing where these boundaries are very rigidly drawn.
That's absolutely true. Lillian Smith, in her great book, has a description of this process. White children, black children growing up in the Jim Crow South had that lightning bolt hit when they first realized what segregation meant. It happened to me when I was 8 years old. A black man came to the wrong door of our house. He owned a shoeshine parlor where my father had his shoes regularly shined, and my father had obviously heard something that infuriated him and stormed off the day before. This man came to our home as my father and I were leaving. He was going to drop me at school and go to work. And he came to the side door instead of the back door of our house. And as soon as my father saw him, he exploded in rage. I had never heard a verbal assault, anything like that, coming from him. I don't remember what he said. I think I was too scared and stunned, but I remember his voice and I remember his rage. And that taught me, when I was 8 years old, there's one door that African-American people coming to our home can use, and that's the back door.
One of the things you also talk about, one of the props in this ethos, this ideology of white supremacy, is the virtue of the Southern white woman.
Correct. That state of protection that was required for white women was, I think, at the core of segregation, at the core of the Jim Crow system. It's one of the things that helped sustain slavery. Everything that I talk about the book relates to race and notions of black inferiority, white superiority. In the antebellum South, in the South of my day, there were some remarkable similarities. A fear of black violence, assumptions about black character and inherent laziness, things of this sort, absolutely ridiculous notions. And this notion that black males were a threat to white Southern females. It was almost bred into the marrow of our bones as white males growing up in the South. And I think it had a lot to do with, among other things, sustaining slavery and producing the backlash against Abraham Lincoln that came with his election in 1860.
Well, and also any thought that a good-thinking white man might have about the inherent inequality of this system could be quickly knocked out of them if you suggested that your tolerance for African Americans meant that you didn't care what happened to your wife or your mother. That would become a pretty rough thing to sustain.
Absolutely, yeah. Absolutely. That was the bright line that was drawn. We were all, as white Southern males, supposed to defend that barricade.
So what happens when you come to your consciousness? What does that mean for you when you realize that you were, you know, part and parcel of this system?
It was sobering. It led to a family blow-up. Another one of those scenes I haven't forgotten. It was second semester of my senior year. I hadn't really started revealing to my parents how I was changing and my new attitudes. And I was home for spring break, and we were having dinner. My father started going off on the Brown decision, the 1954 Brown versus Topeka Board of Education. And my father was a very good lawyer, but he loved to chew on that bone. And he started in on it, and I just blew up. I said, "Pop, the 14th Amendment, equal protection of the law, it justifies, fully validates the Brown decision. I think I know more about American constitutional history than you do." I said that to my father. And he went silent. I left for college the next day. My mother called me a day or two after I arrived back, and she said, "Charles, I've never seen your father so upset. You've got to apologize." And I sat down to think about it. And in the course of that thinking, I came to the realization that I love my father. He was a very good man, a very good father in many ways. And I made that call. And he accepted my apology. But it meant that there was some ground we couldn't walk on in the future. And I think we both realized it. Neither one of us tried to bait the other one. We weren't going to change each other's views. So we found other things to talk about, and being Southerners, we talked probably more about football than anything else.
We think about that story and your father's rage at a black man using the side door instead of the back door. Story's not about your father, but if you extend that and you look at the political milieu today, the amount of hate speech at the highest levels of the political discourse, hate against refugees and certainly African Americans, what do you think? It feels as though things may not have changed much.
Unfortunately, I think there's a dark undercurrent of race coursing through American life to this day. It's not confined to one section of the country. I think it embraces is all of us. And I think we have got to recognize this. We've got to be conscious of it. And individually, we've got to do what we can do to make things better.
But it seems to me that you came to this on your own. There was some form of education and gradual revelation that brought you to this. If we think about the way political discourse is working today, egging on white Americans who feel as though they're having something taken away and react with the same rage at unpropping whites, you know, white supremacy because it'll take away an unearned privilege. I mean, how do you do that? If it seems to me it happened to you. You didn't set out to do it, and there was no program that got you there.
That's a really good question, and I wish I had an answer to it. I tend to think in terms of colleges and universities and what we as educators can do. We can diversify our faculty, staff, student body. We can show them a campus that looks like America. I think it's very important that we support student groups, activities that bring students together across racial and ethnic lines. We do this with athletics all the time. I'd like to see similar resources invested in theater and dance and music and art and the things where kids form friendships and get to know each other. We often ask our freshmen to read a book or two before they come to campus. I've got a couple of candidates. You want to hear them?
Real quick.
Okay, Ann Moody, Coming of Age in Mississippi, and Melton McLaurin, Separate Paths. One from the white side of the color line, one from the black. I think if our students could read those two books, they would have fantastic discussions in their dorms and dining halls.
We'll post those titles on our website as well. Charles Dew, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you, Frank.
Charles Dew is a professor of American history at Williams College. His new book is called The Making of a Racist, and it's now out from University of Virginia Press. You can find out more at our website, stateofthings.org. Our program is produced by Laura Lee, Anita Rao, Charlie Shelton-Hormand, and Katie Barron. Robin Copley is our technical director. Brett Wolf, WUNC's news director. North Carolina Public Radio is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.